Welcome. This is Marcia for Radio Eye, and today I will be reading National Geographic Magazine, dated July 2022. As a reminder, Radio Eye is a reading service intended for people who are blind or have other disabilities that make it difficult to read printed material. Please join me now for the continuation of the article I began last time called We Are Here, this article by Charles C. Mann. Each team puts 30 players on a soccer-like field with a 12-foot post at each end. Every player has two sticks, always handcrafted with the wood bent over and lashed onto a loop at the end. The loop has leather strips that form a pocket barely big enough for the small leather-covered ball. Using only their sticks, players carry, pass, or shoot the ball. Hands aren't allowed. Each side tries to hit its goal post with the ball while preventing the other from doing the same thing. Few rules limit how the players can do this. When some Chata acquaintances at the festival tried to teach me how to catch the ball, I could barely do it. One of the few times I was successful, they rushed me. I looked up to see four guys with sticks charging in my direction. Did I mention that the game is played without padding or helmets? That some people play barefoot? The guys plowed into me. One reached out a hand to help me up. "Now you're Choctaw for today," he said kindly. "You're ready to play," said another. In the old days, the game was played in the open countryside, often with hundreds of players on each side. Entire communities gathered. Competition was so intense that Ishtabali is known as the little brother of war. It was sometimes used to settle disputes. Some of that rowdiness is still present. Games stop for little but jump balls and injuries. The crowd yells and bangs drums as people collide on the field. When players catch the ball, opponents pile onto them. "I'm not sure I'm ready to play," I said. The Chata homeland was the fine bottom land of Mississippi. After Europeans arrived, Chata leaders played Spain, France, and England against each other, trading with all sides and creating prosperous farms and ranches. The nation's first decades with the new United States were largely peaceful. The Chata even allied with it against Great Britain and its native allies in the War of 1812. The great Chata leader, Pushmataha, was commissioned as a brigadier general. Despite their alliance, the Chata became, in 1830, the first of more than 40 nations forced to leave their homelands and move to what was then called Indian Territory, now Oklahoma. Their journey inaugurated the infamous Trail of Tears. In return for ceding their land, the Chata made one crucial demand, sovereignty. In the treaty, the U.S. promised that no territory or state shall ever have a right to pass laws for the government of the Choctaw Nation, and that no part of the land granted them shall ever be embraced in any territory or state. That promise was not kept. In the next few decades, much of the new Chata homeland was parceled off to other native nations. The rest was converted from communal to private land and distributed to tribe members, who were often strong-armed into selling it to settlers. In 1907, Indian Territory was incorporated into the new state of Oklahoma. Indigenous nations outside Oklahoma faced similar losses. Today, the average reservation is 2.6% of the size of the original homeland. Not only did the government go after tribal land, it also went after the tribes themselves, setting dates to terminate them as legal entities. The Chata came within a whisker of termination. Other nations weren't so lucky. If there's a single beginning for the turnaround in Native America, it may be the passage of the Indian Self-Determination Act in 1975. Pushed through by a wave of indigenous activism, it created mechanisms for tribes to establish and, most important, direct their own programs. It meant bringing back Choctaw dance and Choctaw language, which had been suppressed by missionaries. And it meant the first openly played games of Ishtabali in decades. The game had been forbidden in the old Indian schools. All the while, nations across Turtle Island were fighting to escape state laws that restricted their actions, often keeping them from having an economic base. After two legal battles that reached the U.S. Supreme Court, establishing that Native nations are not subject to many local or state laws, Congress in 1988 passed a law that cleared the way for them to run gaming operations. Today, the Choctaw Nation has 7 casinos in southeast Oklahoma and more than 200,000 enrolled members. The nation has become a powerful economic force responsible for almost 100,000 jobs, and it's rebuilding its land base, having bought some 60,000 acres. With the income from their casinos and businesses, the Choctaw construct roads, support schools, put up clinics, and build homes for their elders. They have erected 17 community centers, one in almost every town in the nation. Sovereignty is at the basis of everything we do, Sue Folsom, the cultural project manager for the nation, told me. Folsom supervised the development of the new cultural center, which opened last year. One of its most prominent exhibits treats the contentious history of the Choctaw and the U.S. government. It's called Protecting Our Sovereignty. Renewing the World. Karuk prayers don't sound like Christian prayers, Leif Hillman said. I don't close my eyes and bow my head. Those are acts of subservience that are not part of Karuk belief systems. One way to describe Hillman would be to say he's the former longtime director of natural resources and environmental policy for the Karuk tribe. A second would be to note that he's an officiant during Pekyavish, the annual ceremonies that renew the world. A third would be as a key strategist of a long struggle that resulted in one of the most consequential environmental agreements in North America in many decades. But I like to think of him as the man who helped ruin Warren Buffett's big day. The morning we met, Hillman was standing next to Bill Tripp, now the Natural Resources Director. We were on a ridge, looking down at the center of the world. Hillman wore a t-shirt with a drawing of a salmon. His hair was neatly tied back, and there was a pencil behind his ear. A gray baseball cap shadowed Tripp's forehead and eyes. His t-shirt said, Karuk Fire Management. Below us was the confluence of the Salmon and Klamath rivers, rushing together in a high-sided bowl ringed by mountain peaks. Near the junction was a gravel flat, the site of Katimit Inn, a former Karuk village and one of the places where the Karuk renew the world. World renewal is a ceremony to align Karuk people with the living processes around them. Humans can lose the balance between giving and taking. The rites seek to correct for this. The prayers at world renewal tell the spirit people what we're doing, Hillman said. It's like, listen, mountain, you explain the acts as you perform them. Spirit people are creatures with supernatural aspects, which include anything from mountains to people. Humans are the worst of the spirit people because we have the shortest memory, Hillman said. The prayer is to remind people of their obligations to the other spirit people. Prayers are teaching devices, Tripp said. It's a codification of our management processes, what we've learned from surviving in this place for a long, long time. The prayer says, this is what we're doing with the fire. This is what happens in the water. Both men were born and raised around the Klamath River, which begins in south-central Oregon, cuts through the Cascade Mountains, and empties into the Pacific Ocean in far northern California. The river zigzags through forest scenery of the spectacular rugged variety. Like the Egyptians with the Nile, the river tribes are shaped by the Klamath. Indeed, the Karuk have come to be known by their word for upriver. Downstream are the Yoruk, whose name derives from the Karuk word for downriver. The names are more than geographic markers. They position the societies with respect to their greatest resource, the enormous salmon runs that flow up the Klamath to spawn, or rather flowed up. The river used to be home to the third largest salmon migrations in the continental U.S., celebrated for its Chinook salmon. Now their numbers have been reduced by 90%. The annual movements of the fish were a demonstration of the order and benevolence of the world. The Karuk Yuruk Hupa, who live on a big Klamath tributary, and the Klamath tribes, who live at the headwaters, kept that order by managing their landscape, regularly subjecting their terrain to low-level burns that prevent severe fires and maintain uncluttered areas, promoting game and useful plant species. This arrangement abruptly changed in 1848 when the United States won California in the Mexican-American War and the Gold Rush began. California had several hundred indigenous groups and a scattering of colonists. Within 4 years in the U.S., had signed 18 treaties with 134 native communities, including the Karuk, Yoruk, and Hupa. But Congress refused even to consider them, and the government simply took most of their land. California passed a law allowing any white person to effectively enslave native people, and then the state and federal governments sponsored what amount to death squads. Thousands of indigenous men, women, and children were murdered. Bounties were offered, 50 cents for a scalp, $5 for a head. The federal government turned much of the Klamath Basin into national forest, and the California-Oregon Power Company, COPCO, built four enormous hydroelectric dams on the river, all of them blocked salmon. Worse, they helped spread disease. As rivers flow into reservoirs, the water slows down, warms up, and deposits sediment. Slow, warm, silty waters are ideal habitat for the tiny aquatic worm that hosts Ceratonova shasta, a parasite that kills salmon. In May 2021, a Yurok monitoring team found 90% of the juvenile salmon swimming downstream were infected with C. shasta. Most of them would die within days. Reservoirs are also perfect habitat for a species of cyanobacteria called Microcystis aeruginosa. Not only does M. aeruginosa turn the water bright green and make it smell like rotting seaweed, it also releases a toxin linked to liver disease in salmon and people. In the world renewal ceremonies, officiants had stood in the water. Now doing that would risk their health. With fire suppression and dams transforming their homeland into something unrecognizable, the Klamath societies began to fight back. The dams ended up being owned by Berkshire Hathaway, the giant holding firm controlled by Buffett, the Omaha, Nebraska billionaire. Every year, Berkshire Hathaway hosts a shareholders meeting in an Omaha stadium. Surrounded by nearly 30,000 delirious fans, Buffett holds court. "It is his favorite day," Hillman said. "They just love him. Well, we decided to ruin it." In 2008, Karuk, Yurok, and Hupa activists, many dressed in traditional clothes, waited outside all night to be first in each of seven lines set up for people to ask questions. When Buffett brushed off the first question about the dams, the person in the next line also asked him about them, and the next, and the next. Flustered, Buffett cut short the Q&A, and security officers removed Hillman and some of the other activists. "He just hated it," Hillman said. "They had to drag us out yelling from their party." Eventually, a deal was negotiated with Pacific Corps, the subsidiary that owns the dams. They said they'd take down the dams if we promised never to go to Omaha again. I said I never wanted to go there in the first place. Buffett had agreed to what might be the biggest dam removal project in history. It didn't happen right away. No clear legal process for taking down giant dams existed. Congress let legislation lapse, leaving California, Oregon, Pacific Corps, and the tribes to find the $450 million needed to take down the dams. Afraid of creating a precedent, politicians, dam owner, operators, and risk-averse bureaucracies put up obstacles at every step. But after more than a decade of legal strife, the dams are scheduled to come down next year, a major step toward recreating the landscape of Hillman's ancestors. Similar struggles have been occurring all across Turtle Island. In 1984, the Tlaoqueat began blockading Mieres Island, preventing timber companies from clear-cutting ancient cedars in a confrontation so furious it's called the War in the Woods. The Osseti Sakowin, the seven branches of the Lakota and Dakota, are still in a standoff with the United States over the Black Hills, illegally seized in 1877. Cree, Métis, and Dene in Alberta have been fighting oil sands development for two decades, and fights against pipelines, the Dakota Access, the Keystone, XL, and so on, continue to make headlines. In Washington State, a group of 14 nations battled local, state, and federal officials for decades over their rights to fish and manage salmon, a billion-dollar industry in the state. Treaties signed in the 1850s had guaranteed the region's first peoples the right to fish and hunt at all usual and accustomed grounds. Today, after multiple Supreme Court rulings, indigenous and state governments co-manage coastal waters for salmon and steelhead. Four nations in Oregon co-manage fisheries on the Columbia River. In 2018, the Supreme Court affirmed a lower court decision ordering Washington State to spend billions to fix or replace about 1,000 salmon-blocking culverts, upholding that the right to fish was meaningless if a state destroyed the fish. The last time I saw Hillman, I told him I'd visited one of the Klamath dams due to be removed next year. I had walked around the reservoir, which was thick with Microcystis aeruginosa. The water stank and was intensely green. Wish any luck, Hillman said. You'll be the one of the last people to see that. Restoring the corn. When we walked into the barn, Angela Ferguson was sitting in a camp chair, glasses propped on her head, ankle deep in ears of dried corn. Around her, the husking bee was in full swing. A dozen people in western New York, shucking and braiding, plastic crates beside them full of husks and cobs. The cobs were glossy and multicolored, a panoply of red and yellow and cream and slate blue-gray. Inside the barn were three main rooms. Like a cheerful, exuberant general, Ferguson directed operations in the middle room. Behind her and the other huskers was a second room full of wheeled metal racks. Corn ears, braided together by their dried husks, hung from the racks, several dozen varieties, none of them remotely similar to supermarket corn. More braids, equally varied, dangled from the ceiling. All of this would be ground into flour for traditional dishes or preserved as seed for indigenous farmers. The third room remains closed with an attendant outside 24/7. Ferguson lets us inside with a flourish. It's a library, but instead of books, the room is lined floor to ceiling with neatly labeled glass jars. Inside each jar are corn kernels, more than 4,000 varieties altogether. I cried when I saw these for the first time, she said. It was more than I could have imagined was possible. Ferguson is Onondaga. The Onondaga are one of the six nations of the Haudenosaunee Iroquois Confederacy, whose homelands are in what is now upstate New York and southern Ontario. In tales by early U.S. writers such as James Fenimore Cooper and Washington Irvin, the Haudenosaunee are portrayed as fierce warriors, and it is indeed true that for three centuries the Six Nations have furiously resisted their colonizers. But that misses a much more important part of their identity. The Haudenosaunee thought of themselves as highly skilled farmers, people who transformed their northerly landscape into an agricultural powerhouse. The foundation of that powerhouse was corn. The world's most important staple crop, corn was developed almost 10,000 years ago in southern Mexico. By about AD 1000, it had spread throughout Turtle Island. Everywhere it went, local breeders adapted it, creating thousands of types, from 2-inch cobs with tiny, deep red kernels for popcorn to cobs almost 2 feet long with thumbnail-sized kernels that, Ferguson said, dance atop boiling soup. This festival of diversity is preserved in the Onondaga Library. The U.S. takeover of indigenous societies is often described in terms of land, but it also was an assault on culture, banning suppressing religions, suppressing languages, even prohibiting games like Ishtaboli. A little noticed aspect of the conquest was that it became even harder for indigenous peoples to grow and eat their own foods, as central to their identities as it is to other cultures around the globe. Ferguson told me she is just a traditional corn grower who always had a little family garden. 12 years ago, she decided to work on a larger scale, growing corn for elders. It was selfish, she said, laughing. I just gave them some corn, and they gave me so much knowledge in return, recipes at first, and then the history of our people. In 2015, she persuaded the Onondaga Nation to help her expand. She and her collaborators staged community gatherings with free food, traditional Haudenosaunee varieties of corn, of course, but also beans, squashes, fruits, vegetables, fish, and venison. The food draws people together, Ferguson said. It's medicine. Medicine, in our sense, not the drugstore sense. I would get up from the table and feel the power of our community. The next year, Ferguson co-founded Braiding the Sacred, with the goal of bringing back indigenous farms and foods across Turtle Island. Braiding the Sacred is part of a movement called Food Sovereignty. From this perspective, food is a bond that unites people, health, and land. One of the organization's first tasks was to visit the home of Carl Barnes. Born in 1928 in the Oklahoma Panhandle, Barnes was fascinated as a child by the tales of his Cherokee grandfather. Like the Haudenosaunee, the Cherokee had a rich agricultural tradition, but one that had faded. Barnes worked his family farm and used his spare time to collect the seeds of ancient varieties from across North America. By the 1990s, he had thousands of types of corn, beans, squashes, and other crops. Barnes, who died in 2016, willed his collection to friends who contacted Braiding the Sacred. A year later, the collection began arriving on Onondaga land. Ferguson had the melancholy realization that some of these seeds no longer have their people. The people who grew them were wiped out or absorbed into other tribes. The seeds are here, but they're like ghosts. Now Braiding the Sacred is working with more than 100 farmers in a dozen or so nations. The younger generation is the key, Ferguson and others told me. I'd just seen students at the Akwesasne Freedom School harvesting in the fields. Founded in 1979, the Mohawk Immersion School in northern New York is a center of cultural resurgence. The Mohawk are another of the Haudenosaunee's six nations. Taken to a Mohawk community farm on a cold October day, the teenagers had fanned out into the field, snapping off ears from the plants. Unlike today's hybrid corn, traditional varieties grow to different heights. The students were harvesting Mohawk short-nose maize, usually from 3 to 5 feet tall. Typical agricultural machinery can't harvest it. The kids, talking across the corn rows in English and Mohawk, tossed the ears into a cart pulled by a trailer. Watching them like a proud grandfather was Tom Kanatsakanakyat Cook, a Mohawk writer and longtime activist. He'd been one of the original stringers for Akwesasne News, the first pan-indigenous newspaper in the 1960s. I asked him if we were looking at a vision of the future. I see what you're getting at, he said, but this isn't the future. This is happening now. Bringing buffalo back. It was winter camp in deep snow, and the Siskiyiskaapi had no food. As the sun set, one young wife went looking for firewood. In a copse by a river, she heard chirping from a tree. In a fork in the tree was a stone. The stone gave her songs. Teach your elders to sing these songs, it said, and I will provide for all of you. That night, the Siskiyiskaapi elders came to her teepee. Everyone was faint with hunger, but still sang the songs. A storm came up, burying the teepees in snow. But when families dug themselves out the next morning, they saw buffalo walking through the camp. I first heard the story of the buffalo stone on a bluff above Two Medicine River in northwest Montana, a place where the Siksikanatapi have gathered for centuries. Imprinted in the soil were scores of rings, formed by laying stones on the edges of buffalo hide teepees to hold their edges down in the wind. I had been invited to a tribal buffalo harvest, one of several held every year, to teach Siksikanatapi children about the animals' roles in their culture. In the cold, bright March morning, where elders offering prayers and songs, and the tale of the buffalo stone, sage, and tobacco smoldering in a little cast-iron pan, wide-eyed kids in winter coats taking everything in, three eagles wheeling above like a sign. The Siksikanatapi are a confederacy of four nations, three in Canada, the Siksika, Blackfoot, the Kainai, Blood, and the Piikani, Pygon, and one in the United States, the Piikuni, Blackfoot. The Piikani and Piikuni are branches of the same culture, now split by the international border, known to the Siksikavati as the medicine line, a mocking reference to the supposed power of a border they don't accept. Not far from the ceremony was part of the tribal buffalo herd, a few hundred animals, lured by hay scattered on the ground. I rode in a pickup toward them with two of their caretakers, Shaz Racine, leaning out of the passenger window with a gun, and his cousin, Rob Wagner, careful at the wheel. The buffalo slowly turned their heads to follow our progress. Their breath made clouds in the wintry air. Racine said he'd know which buffalo was right when he saw it. He said that often an animal presented itself to him. It was choosing to give its life. The Rocky Mountains' peaks agleam with snow rose from the horizon like a cupped protective hand. A cluster of buffalo ambled toward us. Then a big bull stepped out and lowered itself to the ground. The others moved away. The bull looked straight at us. Racine's gun had been blessed with sage smoke. Its report was startlingly loud. The bull slumped, dead in an instant. "Did you see how it gave itself? Did you see that?" Racine asked. The two men winched the slain animal onto the back of a flatbed truck and drove it to a paddock where, after a prayer of thanks, the adults showed the children how to remove the head and fur and entrails. The stripped body was taken to a small butchering facility on the reservation, where a couple cut it up with a reciprocating saw. Later it would be distributed to the school and community. Less than a mile from the teepee rings was a steep hill, almost a cliff, its vertical face about 35 feet high, a buffalo jump. Hunters enticed buffalo onto the slope that approaches the cliff top. Drive lanes, lines of cut brush, and shouting people funneled the animals uphill. They didn't see the edge until too late. People waiting below dispatched any that survived. Generations of Siksikavati had hunted there. When I walked to the bottom, I saw a foot-thick layer of bones, the relationship of the Siksikavati and the buffalo inscribed on the earth. Ecologists call bison, as buffalo are also known, a keystone species, an organism that the prairie ecosystem revolves around. But buffalo are more than that, says Leroy Little Bear, the Kainai leader and law professor. It's a keystone for our culture, our songs, our stories, our ceremonies. They are all connected to that animal, like corn for the Haudenosaunee, buffalo to the Siksikavati, are a source of identity even more than they are food. A landscape with buffalo was Siksikavati, space warm and inviting. This concludes readings from National Geographic Magazine for today. Your reader has been Marcia. If you enjoyed hearing this content, please give us a call at 859-422-6390. Thank you for listening and have a great day.